Oh, that concludes a pretty flawless side one. Shall we go into side two?
Yeah. Are you sure this is the stuff you want for your listeners?
It's absolutely brilliant.
You're going to be editing the fuck out of this.
This is 80s Ultrafade.
Audio commentary, songs from the big chair,
Tears for Fears.
With Ian Stanley and Dave Baskin.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode. In fact, this could be my favourite ever episode of Atisography. I've been trying to get this together for a while with Ian and Dave, but it's been hard to synchronise everyone's availability. By everyone, I mean Ian and Dave's, obviously. If you love this album, you should love this. I think both previous interviews with Ian and Dave have been amongst my very favourite interviews, and this combines the best of those two, really. So let's get to it. Settle back, cue up the album, and listen to Ian Stanley and Dave Bascom talk about making Songs from the Big Chair by Tears for Fears. I'm talking to you. Come on.
The interview starts now.
Ah, Dave, look at you. We look the same still.
Oh, no, it's ridiculous, isn't it?
You haven't changed a bit.
When was the last time you guys spoke?
Well, I was just thinking about this, Ian.
Go on.
I think the last time you texted me was to say, who's the daddy? I'm the daddy. Your firstborn, so God knows how old he or she is.
Oh, okay. God, well, that's 16 years ago.
Oh, my God.
Was there any context to that, or was it just...
Yeah, well, I was just... Ian just had his firstborn, so... Yeah.
Oh, okay, right, okay. Yeah.
That's quite good. Who's the daddy? I'm the daddy. I like that.
Something like that.
Yeah. I thought it was the Human League single we mixed, but that shows what I remember. Then I see you. Will I see you again?
Will I see you again? I don't know when that was, but it must have been before that. So
yeah, I guess. How are you? You're looking great.
I'm great. I'm really good, thanks, mate. How are you?
I'm all right. My sort of limbs are falling apart, you know.
Right. You're still golfing?
Golfing a lot. That's all I do. That and a bit of a DIY and trying to hide from my family most of the time.
You're in your garden shed there?
I'm in a hut in the Wicklow Mountains. Yeah, I had to give house some...
Is there a big sofa in your hut? Did you move?
Do you know what? You can just see it.
Ah, right. Yes. That's not the big...
Oh, it's been recovered in pink. Yeah, there it is.
That's the same one?
That's the big chair, yeah.
Oh, my God. Wow, that's amazing.
Oh, is it?
How ironic.
Do you remember it? You slept on that a few times, Dave. Drunk, you know, recovering.
Yes, absolutely.
And where are you then? Is that a studio?
Yeah, it's a little sort of studio, yeah. Where I pretend to mix, but don't really do much any these days.
My first question, though, is what do you think of The Tipping Point? Have you both listened to it?
I haven't listened to it.
Yeah, you haven't listened to it? Is that conscious thing?
No, not really. I've heard a few tracks and they sound very nice. I don't know, it's fine, you know, but all the bits I've heard. Don't know, have you heard it, Ian?
Yeah, I only listened to it once. I think it's a fantastic bit of work overall. There are things I don't like, obviously. Some of it is very tough to listen to. The songs about Caroline and stuff, obviously.
Yeah, sure.
That's very hard. I think it was pretty hard to make.
It was, they went through a couple, over a long time,
countries and COVID and all that. So I think they've done a really good job, and it seems to be doing very well.
Yeah.
It's sort of great to hear some of the your classic Tears references. There's a lot of shuffles on it.
Shuffles, yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. You know, it's a little bit, I would call it overproduced, but then things are. But the vocals I thought were really good. Kurt seems to have improved a lot. That's rude. I didn't mean to be mean. It's just like his singing's really good on the record, I thought, from what I could tell. I thought it was, yeah, I mean...
It just reminds me, when the, on that documentary, the TV, the classic albums...
Yeah.
The clip, the ad, the trailer they used was you and Chris talking very eloquently about Emigrants to the World. You were saying about what a soulful vocal, and it cuts to me, and I also go, yeah. My most eloquent moment.
How long were you both interviewed? I was wondering about this because you get interviews with all kinds of people and then they use like 10 seconds of the interview. How long were we actually interviewed for that?
Well, that was, for me and Chris, that was all day actually. It was quite demanding technically because the desk was a bit weird and focusing on, you know, the director kept wanting certain combinations and that's great, say it again. I felt like acting at the end of it. I felt like I said these lines 10 times trying to make a new spin on it, you know. And he says, oh, just talk naturally. I'm not going to sort of pick you up. And then every time I said anything, he's like, that's great. Can we just loop around that bit? And can we? I don't know. So anyway, I thought it came out. I thought it was going to be fucking awful, but actually I thought it came
out. It was okay, wasn't it? Yeah, it was sort of okay. Yeah, I like that series, you know, so it was great
to
do it, you know, it's a proper, however, you know, all the records they do is great.
Yeah,
I was quite happy. I was certainly the first thing I did for God knows how many years, you know.
Being I was quite surprised you did it, actually.
It took a few months to...
Yeah, and it was good. Very good. Glad you did.
And I had to lose a lot of weight and go training. So...
Yeah.
I suppose actually I only did it for the kids really, to be honest. You know, it's like at least you leave something that they can have on video or whatever. Yeah. Not that they give a bollocks. You know, what? I mean, could they care less? They haven't even watched it, bastards.
And they must care that you're involved in
the world. They don't care at all.
Really? Not even about Emigrants to the World.
If I was they couldn't not they just love it.
Are
they younger than me?
I think so.
16 and
how he's 16. No, he's 16. Leon is 16, and
yeah, they will care.
They'll care when they get the royalty checks. When I
so when Lord covered Rule the World, surely that must have been I co-wrote that.
It's not live.
I edit all this stuff out. I'm not going to use any of this anyway.
Yeah, right.
It's a joke.
Used every bit of the last conversation we had.
Did I? I'm sure not. I'm sure I edited something out. I'm pretty
sure. What was the previous one you did?
I did one of these things with Paul, with Mark.
You can call me Paul if you want.
Paul Markowski, isn't it? which is the only interview of, well, the only podcast of.
About Tears? Or?
Yeah, like you did with Chris. Yeah. Not the one that you did with Chris. You did by yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, that was Seeds of Love.
Seeds of Love. That's right. Yeah. I'd sooner talk about Seeds of Love than Songs for the Big Chair. Seeds of Love is so interesting because it's such it's sort of a beautiful failure, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Even though it's successful, but it's like, it's the high point of how it collapses and but it's still great. And
it's hard to be diplomatic about that.
So, yeah. For you, Jesus, you went.
But I think Roland's on the same page now, you know.
So. You nearly died doing that record.
Oh, man. Ridiculous.
What was the worst moment of making it?
I think when we recut Woman in Chains for about the third time, because it's just, you know, I mean, some people are happy doing that, but to me, it's like, what's the what's the point of, I've got all these great sounds. Well, you know, I thought pretty good sounds on the first two. Why do I want to make the effort again? You know, because is this one going to get a bend? You know, so, you know, certain producers and engineers will keep on going, but I just thought, this is
horrible. Well, 4 years was pretty keeping on going, if you ask.
Yeah, well, I was only there for two. So I'm actually, I suppose we've seen them on Monday at Shepherd's Bush.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Where are they playing Shepherd's Bush?
Yeah, yeah.
They're not. They must be doing something bigger than that.
I know, well, they've been doing big ones. But it's great for me to go and see them in a small one. And
yeah, brilliant.
I reminded Roland that...
when did you last see them?
Was from Hyde Park a few years ago.
Okay.
Okay, it's kind of a bit muso for me, you know. It's sort of...
It's a little bit muso. Yeah. They played in Dublin a couple of years ago and it was great, actually. I really enjoyed it. And the great thing was that they had played about 5 years before that, which was terrible. It was awful. Right. And to go backstage after it was like maybe a 1,500, 2,000 seat or 1,500 seat or something. And to go backstage and go, yeah, you know, haven't seen you for a long time. And
that's really
that was shit.
That's the nightmare.
And so this time,
yeah,
saw them in the arena, and it was great. And then was, you know, really grateful and relieved, and got to the hotel late to see Roland. Say, thank God, it was great.
You know, really? Like,
it's always great, you know. But
well, Marty Roland, so the last time we were at that venue together was when I was miming your organ. So this is Love Unwoken.
Excellent. Yeah, very good.
I have to watch that again. That's you on the organ, is it?
Yeah, it would. What, you know, because there's no lights on me at all. And when it comes to the organ, solo, they cut to a litre on the worthy.
So you need to be there.
But you still owe me for that, Ian, because I think you got the fee.
I fucking hope so. Yeah, absolutely. I'll be on the word to my people.
So very good. On Seas of Love, not Seas of Love, Big Chat. Obviously, Ian, you and the touring band for the Hurting Tour, when you were playing, half the songs ended up on the album. So you kind of, when did it actually become an album project? Ooh. The second album?
Jesus. Wow, that's very technical and memory. Okay. What songs did we play on the tour then? We did, was Working Hour.
Mother's written? Talk, Working Hour, Broken and Head Over Heels. So you had
okay. Album, yeah, yeah, yeah. That yeah. sounds about right. But we only had four songs. I can't remember the which Hurting Tour was that, because we were in Europe, really, didn't we? We didn't play anywhere else, did we?
But is that, well, yeah, the end of the tour, by the end of the tour, I think you played the Hammersmith Odeon, I think. And
oh, that one, for a few nights.
End of 83.
Yeah, we did some poxy film of that. That was terrible.
In my mind, yeah.
Yeah, did we do seven nights there? No, we wouldn't. Three or four nights, anyway. Yeah. Oh, God, I hadn't thought about those shows for ages.
The applause made it to listen, didn't it?
The what?
The applause from the Hammersmith. From the Hammersmith.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Very good, Dave. Actually,
and I think Broken, the live version of Broken's from that show as well.
It was probably, like, we wouldn't have recorded many, as I wouldn't have thought, so.
No. Well, I was before I was involved, so.
Couldn't you use some applause from some show on something on Seas?
Oh, on Year of the Knife, yes. That might have been that as well. Yes, maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
I remember hearing it and thinking it just sounded like Screaming Girls rather than...
That's, I think you're right. I think that is...
It's a very young audience.
Yeah, yeah.
That's 83. Okay, that's interesting.
That was...
Yes, because of the applause. The applause on Songs of Me Joe is actually the end of Broken Love, yes.
Yeah. So when was that then? That was that tour was 84, 80, I assume.
83,
it?
I think.
83?
End of 83.
Okay, so then we started... What was I saying? End of 83. So then we started... Oh, well, then we messed around, didn't we, with Jeremy Green and...
Jeremy Green, yeah.
All those... Did we do anything else with someone else before Dave turned up? Did we do anything with Ross? No, that never happened, did it?
So just to butt in, so at what point did Ross Cullum get replaced with you, Dave?
I think he... I think Ross never got a look in after The Way You Are. I think Roland and Kurt were quite, maybe rightly so, that Chris and Ross was a bit overly complicated, but we all were, you know. And I think Ross slightly unfairly got the boot, but Ross is incredibly precise and not sloppy like Dave, you know.
He stayed awake.
I think very early on deciding how to do songs from the big chair. I think we knew we were going to do it in my house. I think I had enough equipment at that point because Jeremy Green came to my house and we did Mother's Talk, which was just disastrous. Although he's quite a good bloke. And then Chris was coming and going. We got Chris in after Jeremy Green because we were struggling ourselves to do something. I can't remember what track. And then Chris came for a day, gave us an idea for a drum track and sort of explained how he would do it. And then I seem to remember Curtin Rowland going, well, we can get rid of him now. He's told us how to do it.
So used him now.
It was really
one crazy. Of the many sackings of Chris, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, which he won't remember that. I bet you won't. In fact, I bet no one remembers that. But I think I had a conversation with Chris saying, you know, we sort of think we could do it ourselves and you can go now. Typical. But I would say you would have been down. So Chris came back and then Dave would have joined pretty soon. Do you remember when you came to Bath, Dave?
Did Mother's Talk at Trident 2 before coming to Bath.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I don't know why you ended up there and where you'd been before that. I know that I was looking through some tape boxes for some reason. Some R.G. Jones was down there. So maybe you'd been to R.G. Jones or something.
R.G. Jones.
And then yeah. I was...
Is that in Wimbledon? Trident
and hadn't got an engineer. So Max rang me up and I was busy. I'd done a few things for him. Yeah. I said, are you busy today? And this is Tears of Fears. I said, oh, fuck off. And,
was R.G. Jones in Wimbledon?
Yes.
Yeah, we were really excited because Cliff Richard used to record that. And some other horrible groups. It was an awful place. But anyway,
I never actually went
there, to digress.
Anyway, so I turned up at Trident. Yeah. So we finished off Mother's Talk then. I think we did a mix there, which never got used. But I think the beat of the drum mix, if you remember that extended mix.
There was so many of them.
Yeah, that was done there.
Did we do the whole track in Trident?
No, I think we were. I think we kept some of Jeremy Green stuff.
Oh, we reworked some of that.
Reworked
we?
It. Yeah, yeah. Oh, in fact, first time I saw you, you were programming MC4 for the end bit. The doodle 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 whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then I think we got on and when we finished that, I got asked to do the album. So then I came into Bath.
Okay.
But that was early. That was before you'd done Shout. Well, you were organising the studio, basically building.
Yeah,
shelving and stuff, and then it seemed like I
acoustic treatment. I call it Dave.
I thought there's no end to this bloke's talents. Anyway, so yeah, it went on for weeks without hearing anything, and I thought, well, they've almost got someone else. And I rang Chris occasionally, said, "No." But that was when you were working on Shout, the demo of it. So, and then eventually, I came to the Bath and started work proper.
So, when did you come to Bath? Can you remember?
Oh, I really can't remember. I guess it's summer. 84, maybe?
Beginning of the summer, probably.
Actually, the first time I went down was a party at Kurt's.
Oh, yeah. He had a big... big house.
Yeah.
Yes, just across the road, with Neil in the gatehouse.
Oh, that's right,
Or dog house.
And also, I remember I brought a bottle of Chablis because I'd heard it was good. And then I'm going, who brought that? And I thought, should I be embarrassed and not own up? Or should I own up? Because it's quite cool.
Yeah, well, it used to be, a pint of Scrumpy. But anyway. <That's
cool. laughs> The thing is, you mentioned Shout, so we queue up the album and try the first track.
Oh, God, have we got to?
Come on, Ian, let's go for this. Come on.
Hold on.
Yeah.
I've got to put my posh headphones on.
God, it's 6.5 minutes long.
Yes.
So, what are we going to talk about?
That's wrong. 3, 2, 1, play.
Good intro. Do you know they don't use the chorus anymore?
Do they?
When they do it live.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hang on, let's
have it. Well, stop there, because this is quite interesting, actually, and it sort of slightly annoys me. So in an interview maybe 5 years ago or more than that, I don't know when exactly, Kurt was always, he was moaning about us, me and Chris, or whatever it was, saying how we forced, I'm using language that's probably exaggerating, but how we forced them to put a chorus at the start, right? So, and Kurt in his way just goes, now obviously we never start the song with a chorus, which actually, if you, when you see them, you'll notice they don't.
How weird.
Yeah,
so I thought the whole point was it was the mantra thing, and I thought the verse was... Anyway, I'll carry on.
Well, exactly. You know, that was our point. And I seem to remember a sort of conversations in the studio. I don't... there was discussion about, you know, it was a bit obvious. You could say it's obvious, but that's the whole point of the song,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
And me and Chris were definitely like, this has to be a hit. This is how you have a hit. You put the chorus at the front, blah, blah, blah. Not that we particularly knew. You just sort of go with it.
But we did have a horrible intro. Do you remember? Like, and in fact, I played it on that classic albums thing.
Yeah.
It was a little guitar thing that goes, do, 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 do. And I always thought, what's that doing there? It's pointless.
I think that's what they do live now.
Oh, no.
So at what point was that junked then, the intro?
In the
I think me and Chris pretty much steamrolled it through. I mean, if they'd been that adamant, it probably wouldn't have happened. But amongst other things, putting the chorus at the front of that put their kids through school, you know. So...
I can't imagine them not doing it that way. It's just, anyway, but it's weird.
It's hard to, well, as a single, if you take off that front chorus, it would just be horrible.
Yeah.
It would never work. It would just be awful. But,
George Martin's thing was always put the chorus at the front, wasn't it?
Well, don't bore us.
Yeah.
That's the first interesting bit. And contentious as it may be. Yes. So, yes, that almost, well, I wouldn't say almost, but it could have ended up without a chorus at the front, which if it had done, we wouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. There's the irony.
Well, I've just missed it. That's your little Hammond solo.
So the verse, Ian, was what you and Chris put together, or was it something that you worked on itself? Because you had the chorus, and you had to find the link between the choruses.
Yeah, we had the chorus for ages. That was the first thing Roland wrote the chorus. I think... Then the Fairlight flutes on the chorus before we had a verse, I think. That's tricky because that's quite integral how that works all the way through the track. You know, it sort of ties everything together because it goes through the verse as well. And although the chords are different and everything, it's quite modal, so it all works. It's only, you know, four or five notes or something. I do remember a moment of inspiration saying we didn't know what to do, how to get a verse. And we were a long time trying to work out. And then I did have a moment of inspiration where I just went up to the grand piano and pushed it up a key to the C and the D for the verse. And the sort of why it worked was that the chorus is down and the verse is up in terms of the chords, you know, which is usually you would have it the other way around, the chorus lifts. But actually the power of the song is because the chorus drops to sort of a minor.
It's a relative minor, isn't it?
It's a relative minor, yeah. So the AF and the D sort of ground. I don't think we ever state the thirds, really, but it has that feel. Obviously, it's dark and doomy, and the chorus is quite uplifting. It's C major, D major, you know, da-da. But it drops down to the A for the chorus, which sort of gives you the reason why you don't need a bridge or anything like that. It's just like block chorus, block verse, block middle eight, block. All four bars, eight bars, very Fairlight written song. You know, you can see that, you know what I mean? It's just like block A, block B, block A, block B, block C, block B, et cetera, et cetera.
It's amazing. It works for 6 minutes, but it is just the structure, like you're saying. It's basically two harmonic things, the verse and the chorus. And it's just
two harmonic things. The skill of it is, and it only just gets over the line in that it holds together.
Yeah.
And obviously Bill's and the introduction of the drums, which was another big thing. But we always knew we wanted real drums at some point. It just worked so well when they came in, when Chris did it, you know. Yeah, it's an exercise. The production of it is an exercise in slowly building it and building it and building it and keeping on going. and then the kitchen sink at the end, you know, saxophone, Scottish guitar solo, you know, it's a bit mental, but there are a lot of relative things. So the guitar solo, for instance, refers to the keyboard melody. You know, the flutes in the da-da-da-da, the guitar solo takes off that. It starts on those notes, if you know what I mean. And that happens a lot through the album, and particularly on Everybody Wants to Rule the World, where things are always referring back to another melody or another rhythm or a part. Somehow we were quite good at that, or Chris and Roland were very good at that. I've only noticed that recently, really, because I've listened to it a bit more.
Okay,
there's a lot of melodies that, you know, you can take over any part of the song and put them over another part.
Play track two, The Working Hour.
It's William Gregory's brilliant sax.
Oh, was that William?
Yeah.
Ah, oh, brilliant! He's so great, William.
Well, we use William and
Mel, the other Mel. Collins, was that?
Yeah, Mel did the kind of melodic stuff that Will just couldn't play for some reason, and vice versa.
Ah. That's all weird, isn't it?
Yeah, but remember we spliced this whole intro on.
Golf Rap, fucking brilliant, aren't they?
I know, they're brilliant, aren't they?
Awesome.
But yeah, we just sort of spliced a bit of tape on the front here so you could do all this, your little synth stuff.
My little synth stuff.
You're doodling, so I was going
to
say that.
This is what I had to put up with in the studio. You just do your little synth stuff.
Oh, good.
That's Roland's rhythm, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's gotta be.
Yes. So we did this at Abbey Road, the backing track for this, didn't we, with Marotta, Joey Marotta.
In Abbey Road. Oh, yeah. Very good. Which studio?
Three, before they rebuilt it.
Oh, yeah.
And I assume Abbey it was tried with Manny Elias first, because he gets the credit.
Oh, yes, we were in, that was a bad period. Were you there for that,
Dave? Yeah.
Chris had to fire.
We tried it on Head Over Heels in the working hour at
Maison Rouge, exactly. Yeah, that was a tough day. We were all hiding and Chris had to...
Manny's playing the Tom intro here. And then...
Oh, yeah.
Jerry,
oh, that's him on the record, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
And he got a songwriting credit, so, you know, fair enough.
But he's a great drum part, this whole...
It is.
So that was Manny, wasn't it, I think?
Like Japan, isn't it? Which we were all listening to. But Manny really delivered, yeah.
There's a lot of Japan influence, isn't there, especially on The Way You Are.
We love Japan.
So you said that day when Chris Hughes had to fire Manny, what was the reason behind that? Was it just he couldn't get the part down?
I just remember just grim faces, and we were trying to play it live. Roland wasn't happy, Kurt probably wasn't happy. To be honest, I don't know why. It's not that hard, I don't think. And live, he used to play it brilliantly all the time, you know. And he came up with a part. Maybe it was playing to a click back then. It was always, this would have definitely been done to a click, right, Dave?
Oh, yeah. It was played to that Lynn pattern all the way through.
Yeah, yeah. So it was probably that, or...
I really can't remember, but I think it just wasn't quite as solid as Jerry did it, you know. And with Head Over Heels, obviously, we programmed it in the end. Jerry tried that as well.
Chris played that, didn't he?
Head Over Heels program.
Okay, it's program real drums. We use samples to it. Yeah, it is very tight. So this is a live take, is it? This is Jerry. Yeah, well, you know.
It's a feel thing, though. I mean, that's the same reason we got Manny to do the intro stuff. Yeah. Because Jerry just didn't have the right feel for that. It's a bit, I mean, without sort of saying we're on that level, but Steely Dan would get in 29 different guitarists.
All
the top of their game, and just... it would just be the one that would make it. And it was a bit like that, I think, after a certain level. But nothing against Manny, obviously, because he's great, but it just didn't quite suit.
No, must have been very tough for him.
Yeah.
I can imagine how I would have felt. But, you know, you're in the band, you toured, you've done an up record, blah, blah, blah. You're making a new record and the producer goes, you're not good enough. Fuck off. Well, I remember Chris was very good at that, though. He's, you know. He would be the bloke to do it and do it very well. But to Manny's credit, you know, he was really good about it. He says, fine, let's get Jerry in, who was his mate anyway, right?
Oh, see, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think he knew him from somewhere. And I remember Jerry being quite, oh, well, you know, Manny can do that, et cetera. But of course, Jerry going, but I can do it better.
Well, I remember someone told me that you had a few days rehearsing with Jerry. And he just couldn't understand why it took so long. You know, he thought, I've got it, I've played it, I know what the part is. He just couldn't understand why. Because, you know, it was such a painstaking way of working we were doing, really. And yeah. People weren't used to it. I wasn't used to it when I first started with you. Really.
No, I think we might have invented it along with Trevor, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Same sort of methodology, I guess.
Yeah, well, it was like having your own studio where you've got abundant time. If you're not paying £1,000 a day or whatever it was, it just sort of frees you up, which is obviously a bad thing and a good thing, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but some things were quick. Everybody was quick, super yeah. quick for us. Yeah. But the working out, yeah, it was it's the two songs, isn't it, shoved together?
Yeah.
I mean, it is great. I think it's my favourite song as a song.
Well, one of your contributions I remember was that you said that we were working out the running order, and working out always felt to me, and I think probably a few other people, like a sort of side two track. And you said, no, let's put it second. I was like, that's just really weird. But it just works absolutely brilliant. Mm. I can't imagine it any other way.
No.
I assumed it'd be like, oh, another, you know, well, everybody, I guess, off the shout or something up, you know, but whatever. Yes. But it's such an odd choice for a second track on an album.
Yeah, I went through this with Mark before, actually, about the running order and how everyone was.
Yeah, Mark's got struggling. A few things about running orders, hasn't he?
I did offer my alternate edit of the album.
You're wrong.
I first gave to Chris Hughes.
Yeah, you are wrong. You are definitely wrong.
I do think Mother's Talk should be the start side two, though, because it's got the fanfare.
No, it's not 6 million.
It's perfect. The running order's perfect.
Okay. I feel better judgment, yeah. All right.
Yeah, I mean, it was just...
You've got the proof, haven't you?
It's so simple. You had to start with Shout. You had to end with Listen. Yeah. You had to have everybody pretty early, but you didn't want it number two because you knew they were the first two singles, right? So you have to have that as number three. And it's just filling in the gaps. It's like, you know, I thought it was like a little... an eight-piece jigsaw that was so obvious.
Just I think the working out so strong that it works, but really.
Yeah, and the vocal, like once you get into it, the vocal is unbelievable. Yeah. Mm. Like that is Roland absolutely believing every word, which he always delivers mostly anyway, you know, but he's some singer. Fucking hell, he's some singer. Such a pop tune.
So that digger digger at the beginning was yours, wasn't it, Ian?
No, it was Roland's, actually.
It
sounds like me, but it was Roland.
Because Chris said it was you.
No, I think album's Roland. I know, I always find that, because it's typically, it sounds like a part I would do. I tried to change it. And Roland was going, what are you doing, you fucking idiot? Because I hadn't come up with it, I wanted to change it. It's hilarious. But yeah,
let's go back to Shout. I remember Chris was never happy with the vocal melody on that. Anyway, let's not talk about
it. With the melody?
Yeah, on the vocal melody. I remember because Roland said to me, hey, what do you think about the vocal melody in the verses? What am I going to say? Oh, it's shit. I said, it's great. And he went to Chris, see? Anyway, back to everybody.
Chris, you're wrong.
Yeah. This was fun doing this, wasn't it?
Well, this was, I remember it was 5 days.
Yeah.
Like Monday to Friday. And it just flowed. It felt like nothing I've ever done.
Yeah. When you do a B-side, it's not. Well, there wasn't. I mean, it kind of obviously was pressure, but it was. It just came together so it's done in such a relaxed sense.
It really was. We must have been in some fucking mood because there's no angst in it. There's no anger. There's no. You know, it's just all peace and love, really. And it's so sweet. But again, not too sickly sweet. Lightweight, but in a good way.
Yeah.
Good middle eight.
That harmony there was your idea.
It was. Yeah. I'm very proud of that.
Yes.
But I had a very interesting period the other day. I was listening. Have you ever seen that website where a bloke dissects the tracks and goes, this is one of the top 48? So he does Everybody Wants to Rule the World.
I've seen that. Yeah.
Fucking hell. When he, like, seeing it through his eyes, where he goes, yeah, listen to this guitar part in the chorus.
Yeah.
I'm going, God, he's right. It's like, it's so brilliant.
Some of it's right, but some of it just makes me think musicologists.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's a couple I've done everybody, actually, and I'm just thinking, what the fuck are you talking about? Because it wasn't done like that at all. I mean, maybe subconsciously, of course, there is some subliminal
Yes, absolutely. It was.
But they always get so many things wrong as well.
Sure. But like this rhythm, this guitar solo, I only realized that part of it is in the choruses.
Yes.
The sort of on off rhythm of it.
Yeah.
But then he comes to the solo and he extends it and, exaggerates it. It's so clever, but without trying to be clever, it was just like natural.
Well, he added this bit in the chorus after a couple of days after we'd done the solo. So,
did he? He got it from the solo. That and okay. Yeah. All right. Well, that would make sense. Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. But all the melodies and all the rhythms work over each other and they all refer back to other parts and so on. And then having the balls to have a minute instrumental section.
Yes.
In the middle.
I know.
The song without really a chorus. Everyone sort of calls this the chorus, but is it a chorus? I don't know.
I don't want to keep on slagging Dave Bates, but he definitely wanted that edited out. He really wanted to do that bit.
Bet he did. Oh, that would have freaked him out.
Neil, two takes Taylor.
Unbelievable. This is Steely Dan. This is as good a guitar solo as you
are. Roland was away when we did this.
Was
when he came back, he said,
"No way."
He said, "Fucking, I can't believe you got a good sound without me."
Wow, he wasn't there.
He wasn't there. So we did two takes.
I was there. Was Kurt there?
Yeah, I think you were there. They were off doing a video. And then Roland just said, we just comped it. And Roland said, where to cut it. But what a record.
Should we move on to Mother's Talk?
Oh, God.
I've been itching to get to Mother's Talk.
Barry Manilow.
Oh, but is it?
Well, yes, I don't know. It's an emulator, isn't it?
Yes, it's an emulator.
Sample. I mean, it's a stock emulator sample, but
yeah.
Sounds like Copacabana. Fairlight, Stabs.
Kurt and Roland, and I'm presuming you as well, Ian, from your reaction, are really down on this version. Oh, I love it. Absolutely love it. It's so much better than the American version.
Do you know what? I don't have a clue what versions are what anymore.
Oh, okay.
I listen to it and I just go, it's okay. I think the song is just trying so hard.
It's a great groove. It's a really funky groove.
It is good drums, wasn't it Jaco Pastorius's drum beat or something?
Oh, it might have been.
Yeah, I think it's from Weather Report. It was one of those. See, it's that sort of 80s. That's a little bit cheap.
I love it. DX7 with a delay on the other side. But this is what I first heard when I walked in the studio. I just thought,
really?
Amazing, yeah.
And we're going, oh, yes.
Yeah.
Don't like it.
Just doing context to what was coming before, you're going from the hurting to the way.
Yeah.
It's got much a heavier sound.
Yeah.
The shout goes one step further.
I mean, it's funny how the band sort of exploded in quite a few directions, more mature versions of what we'd done before.
That's such a Roland.
That is so
down, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Heavily chorused.
Yeah.
Very 80s, that. Early 80s.
It was good live. We always used to open with it, and it was obviously it would work.
Yeah.
Who's the backing vocalist? Some girl.
Oh.
Stevie Lang, is it?
Stevie Lang.
Oh, is that Stevie?
Yeah, that's Stevie, yeah.
Wife of Mutt Lang, or ex-wife of Mutt Lang.
Yeah.
Famed producer of A Load of Bollocks.
Yeah.
Tell us what you really think. Come on, the whole band.
Look, his music is numbers. It's incredible. I mean, I admire it, but it's, you just go, how the fuck do you do that?
So you're a co-writer of the song, Ian. So
I don't know why. And I don't know what I did. I really can't remember it. I think it's probably for the ending. I mean, I probably did something, but, and I remember that the demo was me and Roland working a lot with Jeremy. Oh, we did the demo and then Jeremy turned up and just goes, you've got to have more bass. But I suppose because it's so all programmed, like you can't play that on the piano. Maybe I did some, but I honestly can't remember. It just sounds like a Roland demo to me, spruced up. But I suppose, I don't know. Maybe I did something more. Roland would know. He's got a brilliant memory for all this stuff.
Okay.
So you will have to ask him. This is a bit ropey, isn't it?
It's a little bit, yeah.
Like, what? That must have been Pete, what's his name?
Jeremy Green.
Jeremy Green, but that
I don't think so. Because I remember doing those because it's the Drumulator doing the fills.
Did Roland program all this, or Chris?
I don't know. It was done before. I don't know who programmed it, but I remember recording it.
Yeah. Was it all synced? Did we drive it all off synth? Time code, yeah.
Yeah. Because the time code was bleeding through. And that's my, when I first arrived, you or Chris said, do you know how to get rid of that? And I went, yeah, actually. And I plugged it through the iBox. So that's a producer had shown me a week before. So they thought, everyone thought, oh, he's pretty good.
This is the best bit.
This is the bit you were programming when I first talked to him.
This is a random bass line. This is a Brian Eno exercise in that you pick numbers and program them.
Ah.
Random numbers. Obviously it's in the same key, but they're all random gates and pitches. Like there are some bands who sound like this who are just the worst bands. Do you know what I mean?
That's broken, slowed down, backwards, through a gate. That noise, yeah.
Get out of here, is it?
Yeah. Oh. Goodbye.
Wow. I didn't realise it went on this long.
Well, it's all about writing credits, so not that I'm trying to...
you should have had one, Dave, definitely.
Letting my old grievances out, but on the single version, the American one, I came up with that riff that went... Dum, 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 on the intro. And I remember you saying, we're going to bunch
you
up for that.
There's a reason why you didn't get paid for that, Dave. what's the American one? What did we do that for?
We did it for... It was a re-recording for America. We did it after the album had come out, and we did it at the Warhol. Yeah,
was it a single version in America?
Yeah, purely for America, I think. It was a completely new recording.
Was it a hit?
Top 30.
Was it? Oh, okay.
End of side one.
Hey, Brian, 80sography is really good, isn't it?
It sure is, Sarah. I love learning more about the music of the 80s.
Yeah, we both like doing that so much, we started our own podcast about it.
It's called the Permanent Record Podcast. Why don't you tell us more about it, Sarah?
We select albums from the 80s that are important to us, and we cover the making of the record, chart history, and every track.
Then we give a final review and rank the album on a scale of 1 to 100 record adapters.
We've covered artists like Depeche, Erasure, Hojo, A-ha, Tears for Fears, and the Pet Shop Boys, just to name a few.
Also, we've interviewed classic acts like Men Without Hats and Information Society, along with great 80s-influenced modern bands. So how much would you pay for an awesome show like this, Sarah?
Nothing. It's a podcast. You can just get it for free in your podcast app of choice.
That's true.
So much more interesting things to talk about. Glastonbury. Paul McCartney. I don't like him. I remember going into Air for the first time in Oxford Street, right? Yeah. And he was there. And he was up playing. Was there a machine that you could play a little some?
Yeah.
And I walk in and I go, oh, hello. You know, it's Paul McCartney. Fair enough. And he goes, oh, hi. And I'm like, you have a little chat. And he goes, what are you doing? I said, oh, we're in Tears for Fears. We're just starting to record. Oh, I was in a band. It's called the Beatles. Right? And that's what he's like. That's what the public don't see. He is like
Bill Collins said something about this. I just read the other day. He said it ages ago, but did you hear this? He hates him as well.
Bill Collins.
Bill Collins introduced to him and his wife and said something, you know, gave him some praise. And Paul turned to his wife and said, oh, our little Phil's a bit of a fan. Really sort of condescending.
He is so condescending. Yeah. It runs through his body. Like, you know, maybe he deserves to be. I don't know. He is a godlike genius and all that, but he's a... And he didn't pay me for a session I did when Chris did Flowers in the Dirt.
Ah.
He didn't even credit... Well, he wouldn't credit me because I replaced a bunch of Wix's playing.
Oh, right.
Or sounds more than playing. Wix is good. But yes, he wasn't having it. So they didn't pay and they didn't credit, obviously. But there are so many stories about McCartney being a twat. Bob Clearmountain. Do you remember, is it Simon Elliott, the drummer, or Stuart Elliott, the session drummer?
Simon Phillips.
Yeah.
Simon Phillips.
Yeah,
Simon Phillips. That's right. Yeah. And does he have a habit of like, when he's playing the drums, sort of?
Not that I know.
No, there's another one. I think it's Simon Elliott or Stuart Elliott or someone like that.
Who
we used once, right? Who has this habit of going, you know, singing the song to himself when he's playing the drums in the studio. He'd done some stuff on McCartney's album and Clear Mountain told me he was mixing it and he heard this in the back, like just when he soloed the drums, he couldn't hear it, obviously.
Right.
And McCartney goes, what's that? And he goes, oh, it's just Simon's thing or Stuart's thing, whatever it was. And my colleague says, I'm the singer in the band. Get rid of it. It's like, will you? So anyway, he's too old to be playing as well. There should be a ban on, unless you play the blues, there should be a ban.
I agree with that. Totally. Yeah.
Item. 3, 2, 1, play.
So Ian, are you on this at all?
I don't think so. I don't think, why isn't it playing?
Ashley. Oh, it takes ages to get going.
Mm. Oh, does it?
Yeah, there's loads of...
Oh, there it is.
Rubbish at the beginning.
No, I mean, I'm certainly not playing. Who plays the piano? Is it Andy?
Roland.
Oh, really?
Roland, yeah. Oh. Roland at Air.
Where, in Air, okay.
Yeah.
Did he sing at the live then at the same time?
No. Your place, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I remember going out to Air just a couple of times just to do the piano. I think we probably did the Head Over Heels at the same time, maybe.
We did listen as well on at the piano in
really?
Air. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
In Air, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it would have been one. The big, yeah,
we must have done, piano. Yeah.
He probably had a day.
I remember doing it in the big room, yeah. Yeah. So he must have just gone up to do piano, and we did the opera on listen. That,
yeah.
So did you do it to a click?
Yeah, you can hear there's the little Ian going.
That was playing. He played to it.
Yeah, but this is obviously the one that
he's pretty talented.
By Robert Wyatt,
bastard.
Chris has been playing. A lot of people love it. It doesn't do it for me particularly.
Well, the song.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit. I don't like the Scorpio line. That's fucking cringy, isn't it? Is it Scorpio or Virgo or something?
Oh, I'm a Virgo too. But then he decided he was Leo after that. He's now Leo.
That's the point. He's not Virgo. Good vocal, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, does anyone ever go, that's my favourite song on the record? You ever heard that?
Was it not Kurt that said it should go on the album?
I remember him saying that. Yeah.
Could be.
It was a B-side, and then we redid it for the album because Kurt thought it was too good to.
Oh, did we do it as a B-side, really?
Yeah.
It certainly has merit, whether you like it or not, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly works on the record. It's a good low point. You can't all have...
Yes, like, exactly.
Mother's toy, you know, so it adds to the journey of the album.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, going back to the running order, I think it's almost a template for just a perfect running order in my head. It is a fantastic journey, the whole thing.
As an album where you have to get up and turn it over, kids, take note. But as a CD, it's slightly different, isn't it? Where it just plays continuously.
Yeah.
Who's sax on it?
That's William. That's fun off the demo, actually, yeah.
Is that soprano, is it?
Yeah.
He's fucking brilliant.
He's great, isn't he? Who'd have thunk, though, when he's
playing,
that gold fret was in him, is well.
Seriously.
So to speak.
So, Dave, when you've got a song this kind of sparse, is it hard to mix? And
not particularly, no.
Yeah.
I think we...
How many goes did it take you?
This was one, I remember, this was one mix, because Chris was away skiing when we did this.
When we mixed it?
We mixed it in Germany, yeah, and he came back and said, because I remember this is trivia, but we did a mix, Roland took it away, he said, the piano's too quiet, so we just came back in and turned the piano up. But in that process, it kind of dwarfed some of the little elements, like the all these kind of little weird elements. So Chris wasn't happy about that when he came back.
You sent him the mix and he said the piano was too quiet.
No. Roland was there when we mixed it.
Yeah. No, we were there in Germany. I remember the four of us were there.
Yeah.
And on to Austria, right?
No, we mixed it in Austria, in Germany.
Yes. And then we went skiing after we'd finished.
That's right.
In Munich. It's very jazzy, isn't it? What are all these chords? I wouldn't know what these chords were.
And then we did a re-recording LA.
Mm.
Remember?
Well, sort of. Why did we do that?
I think it was because I done a track and dedicated to Robert Wyatt.
Mm.
And
this is quite misses. Robert Wyatt, isn't it? Seasong. Yeah,
that's right. As we did Seasong, that's right.
Yeah.
This was inspired, dedicated to Robert Wyatt. And his missus said, fuck, just dedicating him something. Do one of his songs, make him some money. So that's why we did Seasong.
We did. We did Seasong, put it on the B-side of Everybody.
It's the B-side, I believe. So was that why I Believe was a single then? So it was basically a Robert Wyatt.
No, we didn't have anything else. We wanted Working Out to be a single, but it was the record company going with a fourth single just to
officially. The remake of I Believe was actually a live recording, wasn't it? It was from that film we did, and then we just tarted up a bit.
Oh, yeah.
And then we recorded Sea Song as the B-side to that. That's right. Sea Song's amazing.
Absolutely. Yes, that's good. That's really good. Weren't we also into, what's that, Elvis? Oh, the Clive...
Shipbuilding.
Clive Lang Shipbuilding.
Yeah.
Is this meant to be a version of Shipbuilding type thing?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
How 80s does that sound?
Yeah, really.
This is the most 80s one of the lot, really. It's that bass, isn't it? I think it's that program bass.
It's like a Steinberger sample, yeah, or
it's
something.
It's Kurt Steinberg sampled in the Fairlight, I think, probably.
How did we get the bend on it? Do.
I don't know.
Was that on the wheel?
Wheel, I suppose.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Oh, it's not a great tune, though, is it? I don't know.
Not really.
So
this is the weak. Right, this is the weak point on the album.
It is. It's like a bad version of Mothers, or a different. Like if the whole album had been Mother's Talk and Broken, and that, you know, it would just be...
Oh, a whole album of Mother's Talk. I've had that dream. I'm sure I have. The thing is, if you don't have Broken, you've got...
I
Believe, Head Over Heels and Listen. You've got three ballads. You need a bit of up-tempo.
I think Broken's probably one of the oldest songs, isn't it?
Definitely the oldest song. Yeah. It was a B-side. Mm-hmm. Should have stayed a B-side.
Oh, yeah.
It's so derivative from other stuff. It was all right live, I suppose. But yeah, we did need up tempo. I remember had a conversation that we needed up tempo stuff. It was all getting a bit too.
Yeah.
But also, we were short of songs, right? Like we had no songs.
Absolutely.
I was going to say, what would you have put instead? If you didn't have Broken, what would you have had instead?
Oh, it would have been a 7-track album.
Yeah.
Interesting. Again, it's like an example. The album just hangs together. It sounds solid as a piece of work, but it is just by luck or something that it is just crosses the line.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, like...
Well, I think for me, I mean, hearing this in isolation, it's, you know, well, as we said, it's not great, but I can put up with it in the context of the rest of the album because, as you say, it is such a piece of work. I know what's coming next. Head Over Heels, great album. I've listened to this. And,
yes.
You know, it's... I don't know what else to say, really.
I mean, it's... Was it three... Two and a half minutes. I mean, you know, there's a reason for that.
But it's almost like two parts of the same song, isn't it? It's just like part A, Head Over Heels, is part B, because they both have the same motif in. So if you think of it as part, like the first part of a larger song.
Yeah.
And it works kind of like...
Then it
like,
does work as an intro. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we probably did it live like that, I would imagine. But the piano motif, this piano motif in Broken came first in Broken.
Mm-hmm. Ah, of course.
You know, yeah, so Dylan would have written the song from that.
Right. Yeah.
Which again is sort of quite brilliant because the extemporization of it, the Mixolydian scales and all that stuff, the modal stuff, it's a brilliant bit of writing. I don't really love the song, but it is great. There's no doubt. It was the sort of loud. I remember it sounds very different to the rest of the record, this, in terms, not hugely different.
Hang on, I'm on Head Over Heels. You're still talking about Broken?
No, I'm talking about Head Over Heels.
Oh, right, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Are you listening to Head Over Heels?
Yeah.
So the drums, I mean, this is all real, isn't it?
No, it's all programmed.
Exactly, it's all programmed. But the amount of air or the samples that we used, it sounds like a brilliant drum track. You wouldn't know, and apart from the timing is so good or precise. But
no, it's incredible because it's hard making program stuff sound real. And you don't question it.
Yeah.
You know, and it just came together really well.
Yes, I mean, but it's the instrumentation from piano, the bass is so solid. Sounding this thing, and it's so big sounding.
It's a great bass line as well. I love the bass line. It's very
it is. This is Kurt's bass line, isn't it?
Yeah. It's as Chris pointed out, it's
Take Me to the River. That's good, yeah.
But it's a fantastic line. It doesn't matter, it's just so great. I mean, when we're doing that classic albums, just the backing track, just drums and bass.
It is
amazing, so solid.
They sound
hooky in their own right.
Yeah, it's very wide open sounding. I mean, I've got to say, it's an amazing mix.
Cheers.
Well, you know, too much reverb, but
of course.
But it is. It's like it just fucking works. Yeah. Again, great vocals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is there a reason why Kurt doesn't sing like on the counter melody? They're both Roland, aren't they?
I think they are both Roland. I think Roland's falsetto. Do you mean that bit?
Nothing ever happens when you're acting.
That's both.
Is that just Roland, is it?
No,
Kurt, I think could easily have done that. I mean, you wouldn't know, really.
Do you think Kurt's on that as well?
Yeah, I think so.
I'd say he is, yeah. That would be a typical Kurt line sort of thing. But Roland probably tracked it, and his voice is overpowering all the time.
Yeah.
And then this melody at the end, Hughes says, you wanted to change. You spent ages trying to
change it. I did, again, trying to be a control freak. I just thought it was, you know, if you want to do Hey Jude, is it Hey Jude or Let It Be? Hey Jude, right?
Hey Jude.
Which was the thing, that the tune... I don't know. It's just not Hey Jude. So I tried to make it Hey Jude and couldn't do it. But I did do a version with me singing, some version of some terrible melody and getting really depressed that I couldn't do it. Again, it's fine, but I thought it could have been better. It's similar to my sort of bugbear with Women in Chains. Just think the endings. Well, actually, the endings, guys, just the words are crap. That's what. And the drum fill. Fucking hell, we never talked about that. I always wanted to talk to you about that. Phil Collins' drum fill is a fucking monstrous. I mean, it's so horrible.
That is about 25 different takes. Honestly, that is like, talk about the syllables. Virtually every beat is dropped in.
Phil Collins, you're shit. Why couldn't he do it? I mean, I just find that extraordinary.
It's remarkable, isn't it? But is that
was it you and Roland just being, sorry to detract, but I have to talk about this. Oh, Jesus. Oh, yeah. That's because the earth thing's out. a little diversion into Phil Collins' epic drum fill. The moment. Okay, we've tried this with loads of drummers. What we're going to do is get the biggest drummer in the world at that time. We'll fly him in and we'll get him to do a drum fill. And it is fucking disastrous. Really. Yeah, Chris tried to, he asked for a writing credit on this. Which,
really?
Yeah. Yes, here we go. This is good. There's something brilliant in this. It's a bit contrived. It ended up a tiny bit contrived, the ending and stuff. Again, it's like, you know, build to a moment. But there are moments of brilliance on this.
It's great, isn't it? It's a fantastic last track as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, where else? And it's got nothing to do with Tears for Fears.
Yeah.
There's nothing like it.
Well, I wrote it originally from my own project, you know, but then Roland heard it and loved it so much. Who did write it? Some fucking dickhead, wasn't it?
Some twat. Again, by accident, really. Just the MC4. Well, I had the chords and stuff. No, it's good. I'm annoyed that no one... It's sort of been overlooked a bit, I think, in terms of films and stuff and all that.
Yeah.
I heard it on a wildlife, fucking wildlife thing about geese. That's great. Thanks.
Very apt.
It's just a beautiful mood, it really is.
Yeah.
So it's around
a lot of that sort of ambient stuff in the 80s that we would like, some of the, I wouldn't say it's Talking Heads like, but it does have touches of that.
Chris is on form with his little touches here now.
Very good.
All the little fairlights and twinkly bits.
That's very great. All that. Although the delay on it is, that's probably what makes it work. You hear the delay there? That's you, isn't it?
Yeah, reverb for days on this one.
Yes. Oh, yeah, there's big effects. I remember mixing this in Munich, and it was just one of those moments where everything was like, no one would say a word for about 3 or 4 hours. Because do you remember?
Yeah.
It was so, like, Ron and Kurt were behind us on the couch.
Right.
We would whisper when we were like, let's turn the guitar, you know, to stuff. Like, it was really an atmosphere. Obviously, because of the atmosphere of the song, you know, but like in the
guitar,
it was like everyone was just, wow, what is this? It sort of only revealed itself in the mix.
I guess so, yeah. Because I remember this middle section coming up where we took a lot of stuff out and just had that backwards.
Was there stuff going through there before?
Yeah.
It is. The space is incredible.
Yeah. And we sweated over those.
By that gap is awesome.
Yeah. This bit, yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Backward strings.
Yeah.
Again, the words, a bit cod political, although quite relevant nowadays as well.
Yeah.
Pilgrim Father, like, where did that come from? Pilgrim Father sailed away? Very odd. Like, if any lyrics for this song, you would have thought Roland would come up with some, you know, classic primal scream.
Yeah.
But a political sort of statement is quite odd.
But I'm the same. I didn't really question the lyrics. He could come up with them to order, though, which is, I was impressed.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Same with his mad scatting vocals on the end. I mean, they're just...
They are insane. The guitar and his vocals.
Yes.
I just think.
And the interplay. That's what I remember doing a track on Seed to Love that was like that. And it's just a joy when he's on form.
It really is.
To watch that.
Yeah, it really is. It's amazing to watch. As someone just pure creative with ability, you know.
Yeah, there he goes.
I mean, it doesn't sound like him, does it? It's so high.
No. And it's amazing you just turn that on, isn't it? Really impressive.
And that guitar sound, that's
great.
Where did that come? That was a Gilmore type thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Again, I think he did those two things the same day, or, you know.
Oh, I bet. It's like you could
interplay.
It's just vocal and guitar.
Yeah.
Amazing sound. Is that a Strat, is it?
I think so. That's what he mainly used, wasn't it? I think.
Yeah.
I can't remember that.
No. It's pedals, though. I mean, that's the same as...
I think he only used a little compressor pedal, if I remember, but whatever. No, that bit was...
Oh, high.
Yeah.
I don't know how he gets... That's proper.
Fantastic guitar.
Mm.
Was there a case of stretching this song out to make the album a decent length? Or was it always going to be around?
It sort of was that.
We did talk about editing it down a little bit, and then Roland just said, no, leave it. Yeah.
The ending.
Yeah.
Just overall. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it matters really. Once it goes, it just goes. Like, it could go on for another 5 minutes. It's just that much.
Yeah. Because you kind of lose yourself in it, don't you?
I mean, when we're working it, I hadn't thought of it. It's an obvious last track, but I don't think we worked on it. Well, I didn't work on it with that in mind. You know, it's just a nice mood piece, you know.
Exactly. It could easily have been a B-side.
Yeah.
But it's undeniable. It's definitely it's nothing to do with the rest of the record, is it? It's just absolutely nothing. You can see the connections between the others, but...
It's like the end credits, isn't it? It's
exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why it works so well.
Yeah.
But also, I think it is, you know, when you're very close to it, you know, you wrote it, and it you know, in a lot of ways, it doesn't sound the rest of the album, but in a lot of ways, it does. It's got Kurt on it. And
I suppose. I mean,
you know, it's stylistically with a lot of.
When all of us get involved, it turns into.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it weird, Ian, having one of your songs at the end of this kind of group album that is.
Sort of is. Apart from. I mean, you know, I love that it is. I think it's fantastic. It's personally my, you know, best bit of work, really, writing-wise and stuff.
That is the end of Songs from the Big Chair.
Oh, that was great stuff. Huge thanks to Dave and Ian. Only wish they'd worked on more albums in the 80s so we could do that again. So much was talked about. There's lots of extra stuff actually after the song. So please listen. Some wonderful stuff, including more of Ian eviscerating Phil's drum part on Woman in Chains. Very entertaining. Please recommend to the Tears for Fears fan in your life, because if I don't like this, then I give up. I don't know what else to do, really. What else? There was the ad for the Permanent Record podcast in the middle of this episode. I put these ads in. I don't get any money for it. I just do it because I feel like it's good to help out other pods, especially ones that I like Anglophilia and Permanent Record. And it's a good podcast. Brian and Sarah go into a lot of 80s albums in detail. I did 4 hours recently on The Miracle by Queen, which is quite something. We had a good life in somebody's face. And they did a two-parter on Songs from the Big Chair, which I highly recommend you check out. I think there's a lot of connective tissue between podcasts such as mine and Permanent Record, Anglophilia, The Hustle. We're not really in competition. I see it more as a collective, all for one and one for all. Audio socialism at work, if you will. So I think it's good to help each other out like that. So check them all out. I know you want to get to the extra Ian and Dave, so we'll not detain you any longer from that. Oh, so I will. I've got a nice email from listener Matt who asked if there's any way he could make a contribution towards the podcast, you know, financially. And it's getting to the stage where I would like to find a way of covering costs. Patreon is out because that requires extra content and I don't have the time to do the basics, really. He suggested PayPal and my wife said that was a good idea, so I always listen to my better half. So hsography@gmail.com is my PayPal account. If you fancy helping with a pound or dollar or euro or yen or whatever or currency of choice, it all helps. Thanks. I hate asking, but thanks anyway. You listening is enough, quite frankly. To explain the song I'm playing out with, last thing, Dave and Ian, I think, conclusively proved that the track listing for Songs from the Big Chair is the right one, okay? I accept that. But in the same way that sometimes, I mean, the album version of Mother's Talk is the best version, but sometimes it's nice to listen to the US version. It's not as good, but it's a different kind of listening experience. It's sometimes nice to do that. So I would still like to present my alternate version of Songs from the Big Chair, modified from what I mentioned in a previous episode, which I called The Working Hour, which was a working title for the album. And The Working Hour works well because I think if you see it as the Tipping Point, it's like the fourth Tears for Fears album, really, in a way. So you've got The Hurting, The Working Hour, The Seeds of Love, and The Tipping Point. It's a good kind of symmetry there because I'm really anal. But anyway, so this would be an album, a very different listening experience. Consider it an album of repeated motifs. Stay with me on this, okay? Just give us a try. So you start with the first minute of Listen, which crossfades into The Working Hour. So you've got basically 3 minutes of instrumental. It's a kind of dreamier way to ease you into the LP rather than the more immediate existing version. And then you go from The Working Hour to Shout, Rule the World, and then end side one with I Believe. You start side two with Mother's Talk, but the single version, so you don't have the dibby 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 dibby. You don't have that bit. Then you have When in Love with a Blind Man, which repeats the motif of The Working Hour from side one. Then you have Broken Head Over Heels. Head Over Heels repeats the motif of Broken. You don't have the 1 minute live Broken version. Replace that, and a listener suggested this. It's a good idea. With the last 2 minutes of Pharaohs, which is the B-side of Rule the World, which repeats the motif of Rule the World. And that crossfades into Listen. And you could even, after Listen finishes, have a couple of minutes silence and fade in the dibby 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 to repeat the motif of Mother's Talk if you want, but I think that's overkill. So it's a very different listening experience. So it provides a couple of functions. One, you have the repeated motif thing. Two, it bulks out side two a bit more because side one is 3 minutes longer than side two, so it evens that out. And three gives Kurt Smith another vocal, so it evens that out. That's cool. And it's not as good as a track listing as Songs from the Big Chair, but it's a different one. So try that, The Working Hour, see what you think. And that cues up nicely, When in Love with a Blind Man. Listen to this, then check out all the extra stuff with Ian and Dave. And then I will see you soon with some more groovy 80s stuff. Sorry, I don't know why I said that. Cheerio. When in love with a blind man, you watch what you say and you watch yourself run with dreams.
shout.
Shout, what was I was going to, Dave, do you remember mixing it? And
yeah.
We had the issue of trying to get it louder so that when the real drums come in, that it was really powerful, but obviously you couldn't have it super quiet at the front. And we had to ride the master fader all the time.
I'm sure you're right. I don't remember that particular. I remember we did two mixes.
There's so little music at the front.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the end, it has to have the same power. So the drum.
That's right. But I don't think we did any master fader pushes. We didn't. We sort of frowned on that sort of thing.
We did frown on it. But I remember. Yes. I remember trying it and saying, well, this is what it should be like.
Yeah, you know, yeah,
we
need
it to be this loud and then get louder. But obviously, compression and stuff would, the radio would be hitting the head, but it really works on radio.
It does. It's amazing. I just listened through while you were talking, and it does sound bad.
That takes us back.
It was great to shut you out. No, it sounded fucking great. You forget actually when listening to our headphones is a bit of a treat. So it is a great record.
It still has a power to it, doesn't it? Which a lot of records from that time don't have. There's a weight to it.
There's a certain weight to it, but it really is just holding on to not being a dirge and not being a bowl of porridge, because it's got enough
rock.
It's very hard to pull off, which is why it took all that time, I guess. Yeah.
It's got enough rock in it, but it's not rockish at all. It still sounds, that was the great thing about it, I think.
It is rock. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I mean, the guitars at the end, that big feedback and all
exactly.
That
if AC/DC had synthesizers, that's what,
yeah,
hopefully. I think one thing, Chris never gets the credit for that little Lindrum pattern, which is just
absolutely
genius.
Yeah, 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 totally.
It's such a calling card.
Well, the way it intertwines with Roland's original, which is Roland's thing.
That's Roland's thing. He had that. Oh, yes, he had that on
there. On Roland's demo, was it just that then? Just the very beginning, that was all the backing. And then Chris Hughes pattern on top of that.
He didn't really have a demo. He just played it because it was just four notes on the synth, on the Prophet, and him singing over it, the chorus, and that was it, and the drum machine. That was absolutely it. And it sounded great like that. I mean, it sounded brilliant like that. So it was really, that's what I got. There's the story. He called me around, said he'd come and listen to it. And I just went around his house anyway, and he played me it. I was like, fucking hell, that's amazing. It was that epiphany moment where you could suddenly see how the album, with that, and even though didn't know about Everybody or anything else, the elements of that with what we had with Head Over Heels, probably in Working Hour, you could see there's a real album with a proper heart to it, you know. Luckily, a few other tunes came along, Everybody especially, I guess.
The Working Hour.
Will Sachs, After Shout, is such a sort of, you know, it's a bit of jazz rock.
You just know you're in for like a really classy album, you know.
It's suddenly a mature record, you know.
Absolutely.
And in that 3 seconds, you got rid of the whole screaming kids, and suddenly it was a listening record in your car. Or that's how we achieved, which is quite rare that you go from a first successful teen album. I know it's not really a teen album, but it sort of was.
And it's quite a bold, especially nowadays, I mean, when no one listens to albums, the fact that you've got to get through, not to get through, but the Working Hour is a big, it's a bit of information. It's a long track. Before you get to Everybody, which is, you know.
You're right. That was the only doubt about it, was that Shout is a big fucking meal, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're having another big meal.
Yes.
But I suppose it was a bit risky, but it just works.
Were you aware what the lyrics are about? The suggestions about the record company putting pressure on them to get products. I think specifically David Bates about getting a single out all the time. And that was part of what the lyrics were about.
Were they? Did Roland say that?
Yeah, I heard him say it recently. Yeah, I didn't know at the time.
Oh, fair enough. I had no idea. I'm not a person who listens to lyrics, really. I always go on the tunes. And even today, you know, it's just like I couldn't give you the lyrics of most of the songs, but you just got an impression, you know. There would be a Primal Scream undertow to it, though, I'm sure, somewhere. It wouldn't be just a tirade at Dave. So he had a couple of pops at Dave then, lyrically.
Was he around much in the studio while this was being made?
He says he was there all the time. I rarely remember. He used to come down, but maybe three or four times, I thought, through the summer. If we're in London, he'd probably always drop in just because it's around the corner. But it's bollocks that he was, like, you know, masterminding it and used to be there sweating over every chord and note.
He probably talked to Chris quite a lot, I guess, because they're
mates. He was on the phone to Chris all the fucking time.
But I don't remember being in the studio hardly at all. You know?
Hardly at all, exactly. And then we'll stick to that, Dave, right? So, Dave, you're a lazy fucker. Bates, rather.
Everybody wants to rule the world.
So Roland did a guitar solo on Shout, didn't he? Did he ever try to do a guitar solo for this song?
Well, he does the first solo, the one we were talking about. But then it was on that last one, I think we just wanted someone a bit more rocky, and Neil Taylor was, you know, obviously we knew him, and he's great at that sort of stuff.
Yeah, he's a fucking brilliant
guitarist.
Neil, one of the most instinctive. Yeah, absolutely. I bet that was Chris still holding on to his Americana type,
absolutely, you know,
guitar. This is going to be the drive time, blah blah blah, and that's exactly what that is, you know,
absolutely. In
a nutshell. So I bet Chris was angling for that type of guitar solo without hearing anything. But then, like, it's so hard to play something like that over one note. You know, it's like a pedaling A and D or whatever it is. And, yeah, the choice of notes and timing, amazing.
It is incredible, really, isn't it? It's really good.
Probably the high point on the record for me.
Yeah.
Really?
And it's two takes, is it? I bet the other take was similar, right? Did he just...
I think so, yeah. Well, yeah. I've mentioned this before. It's just, where we did the joy, like, I still remember because I've got that one anal twat. And I remember we did it, and I said to Ron, it's a bit unnatural, isn't it? Because it's a real jump down the fretboard. He went, fuck it off. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I heard you say it was an edit, and I didn't know it was, or I can't remember that it was. It just all seemed so brilliantly sort of effortless, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good tune. It was only really when we'd finished it that we just went, wow. You know, because we're sort of not liking it, just in like, oh, we have to have another track for the record, it has to be a single. Chris said, we got to work on this, let's do this. And I'm sure me and Roland, and maybe probably Kurt even, were going, oh, it's a bit lightweight, it's a bit of a, you know, there was Catwalk on, was it Catwalk by Simple Minds and
Waterfront,
which is like a leaden heavy, you know, compared to that, which is just golden.
Yeah. But Chris really drove it, didn't he? I think we were all sort of
a bit
throwaway.
Yeah. I still don't understand why the shuffle is so brilliant. I know it's in something is square and something is moving against it.
Yeah.
But it really is. You listen to it, it's a Steely Dan shuffle. It's a Purdy drum. You know, it's that sort of hinting at it. But it is dum da dum da dum. But it's dum da dum da dum in the wrong hands is Waterfront. Yeah. Sorry.
But I mean, the rhythm is already a hit, isn't it? You've got to put the song on top of it, because
it is a very hooky rhythm.
Consciously, it just, you'll just,
I think, didn't Roland, he got it, he said that he got it from some other single. Did you ever hear that? Some drum pattern on a...
Oh, there was a Link single, Throw Away the
Yeah, Link.
I had that.
I've only ever heard him talk about Waterfront, Simple Minds.
It was the two. See,
I always talk about Waterfront, but I think he's, which was a revelation, or I had completely forgotten, he talked about Link, and he would know where he got it from, or whether it was a shuffle or not, but he said that's where it was from in some something. We're still going.
But maybe he got, because it's the crossroads of radio, the hat and the shaker, the but really take it away from just being a boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Maybe that came from Links or something.
Yeah, maybe. It's hard to know, because you can try and recreate it and you just can't. Do you know what I mean? It's like the combination of sounds is so similar, the shaker and hi-hat, they're so, you're not conscious of
it.
It's gliding. But Chris was a master of that anyway.
Very tasteful drum fills as well. I mean, subtle.
Very. Yeah, really punctuation, aren't they?
Yeah.
Emphatic. It's good. It's not the best vocal in the world, but it works.
How many takes would he have done of the vocal?
Fucking hundreds.
Really? Would it have been come together? Would he have done it all the way through? Or
yes, Dave.
We were, Well, I remember we were doing it in Munich, where we went to mix, because it was pretty much the last thing we did. And yes, I think it's a great vocal, but you can't beat around the bush. The first two lines are a bit out of tune, and we just couldn't get it. We just couldn't slot in, you know. So pre-auto tune. I'm saying it's a fantastic vocal, Ian. Very soulful. I think someone
that's what I say. Well, it's Kurt just, you know, Kurt, whether he can sing in tune, you know, I couldn't give a bollocks. It's like Neil Young. Brilliant, right? Yeah. But Kurt has a quality to his voice that is really just unusual in a pop yes. area that yeah. is really plaintive and, you know, sort of crying out. He just has that. Roland has all the technical control and passion, but from a really different place. Kurt is like, sort of sings from the chest, from the throat, really.
Yeah.
Comparatively. But yeah, no, I remember chopping together every syllable of Welcome to My Life.
Yes, I think I can remember now, yeah.
Welcome to My Life. So that's five takes for a start.
Wow.
But that was part of the course with a lot of people.
But we would do that anyway. Yes, you'd do that on Roland's vocals, and yes, it wasn't all one take stuff. It was line, you know, words and lines. And yeah. There were very few vocals that would have, you'd take a whole, I don't know, line even, or a whole verse. Mm. I sort of forget that it's so boring. And Roland, Chris, and their tuning was like, even though a record is so much better when it's in tune, generally, especially a pop record. But Chris and Roland would go, is that sharp? Is that flat? And I'd just be going, oh, it's sharp. Just like, I don't know. I haven't got a clue. I'm just trying to appear like I'm part of it.
Mother's Talk.
Yeah, purely for America, I think. It was a completely new recording.
Was it a hit?
No, it was top 30. Was it? Oh, okay.
I hate it. 27. But, don't you remember making the video, Ian? You're in the video for it.
Yeah, you're being a rock star.
No, that's Head Over Heels.
No.
You're playing your guitar in the video. No.
You're wearing like a leather jacket.
Oh, I thought that was just Top of the Pops.
No, it was a video. to go on YouTube.
Look on YouTube afterwards, yeah? You're definitely in it. It's quite a good video, actually.
And check out the opening riff. It's really great.
I said, right, I'm going to front this group. This group isn't sexy enough. Put me up the front.
I believe.
I remember thinking we all thought Shipbuilding was just an incredible song. I think we thought Elvis Costello had written it, obviously, and then realised that Clive... Is that
Robert White wrote that, didn't he?
Oh, sorry. Okay.
No.
Clive Langer produced it, right?
That's right.
Robert White wrote it.
Shipbuilding was by Elvis Costello and Clive Langer.
Exactly. There we go. Yeah. Robert White.
Hang on. So Shipbuilding was written by Elvis Costello.
Elvis did the words, Clive Langer did the tune. So Clive Langer wrote the tune, gave it to Elvis, and he put it to it.
But it's Robert White version, we liked. Anyway, yeah, whatever.
Robert White, they did the song for, he recorded it first.
Yes, and Robert White's version is unbelievably sublime.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
One of the greatest rock vocals of all time. But Chris would have turned us on to Robert White because he went to see Soft Machine when he was the drummer, right?
Yeah.
That was like Chris was a little hippie in London going to see Pink Floyd and Soft Machine and a little hippie, I don't know. Big hippie. Or not hippie, I don't know.
I knew Robert White was in Soft Machine. I didn't know that Chris had been a Soft Machine fan. That obviously makes sense.
Yeah, his prog rock, his Zappa. Do you remember he used to play Frank Zappa all the time?
Yeah.
Oh god, he was a Zappa head, if there was
totally. Such
a thing. We used to hate it. Or I hated it anyway. It was all nonsense.
I always quite like Zappa now and then.
Did you?
God. Yeah, not I liked bits of it.
Just too angry for me.
Woman in Chains.
It needed something there.
It needs a drum fill.
But we hadn't done anything. You know, no one else had tried it. And I suggested Phil because I'd worked with him. And,
yes. Okay, fair enough. And you would have thought, this would work.
As he said himself, the whole In the Air Tonight was just an off-the-cuff thing that was, in fact, incredibly simple. And there's this huge, great four, or whatever it is, you know, four bars of empty space that's just going, here we go.
And what do you say?
Something amazing in that.
Go.
Of course he couldn't, you know, it was ridiculous. And it was this observant myth going around that Roland lost his temper with him, which he didn't. But it was a kind of like Phil's sort of saying, I'm not giving you what you want. And Roland was going, you fucking invented the big Phil, get on with it. You know, he might have said that
as a joke.
But that's obviously that was just like the best we could get out of it. You know, and it's a mad comp, but it was just
one of those. Mad comp. I mean, honestly, yeah. It sounds like three drummers having a go at it. It is so horrible. Could he just? He couldn't come up with anything, or were you?
No,
you
I think
didn't know was, what you wanted.
Well, partly that, but no, we wanted In the Air Tonight, but not In the Air Tonight. You know, it had to be.
Was he literally told that? Can you do something like In the Air
Tonight? No, I think it was pretty obvious, you know, that we
yeah.
want a big Phil. Who's the best person to do? Big Phil. Phil.
Why didn't you ask Chris? Were you just not on speaking terms then?
Oh, no, Chris was gone. Chris was well gone by then.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Chris
could come back to do that. He'd always bounce back, Chris.
He would
have loved doing that.
We should have done that, actually. I think Roland loved the idea. I mean, it was, as the rest of that album, it was like the chance to work with someone brilliant like that. You know, and I do remember saying, well, at least he'll be in time. I said, he won't. He's out of time. Is he a real drummer?
Oh, God. Have you listened to it recently?
No.
Honestly, go back and listen to it. You will fucking freak out.
But the main thing was, I mean, that song, remember that, I mean, you obviously were there at the beginning of it, but it went through so many fucking versions because it never had a middle eight. And we were jamming it for years at Real World.
Yeah.
Because Chris tried to keep making it longer and longer, the whole middle bit, which just went around the same chords. And it was like that sort of thing, oh, we can do whatever we like. And I thought, what is going on here? And then finally, on like version 29, Roland wrote the middle eight. And I thought, God, that's brilliant. Perfect.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
It's still. And then you've got the big key change then, which is, you know, it's a tricksy thing, really. I mean, I like it a lot, but it never quite, the dynamic isn't quite right. You know, this when the third verse or whatever it is, the strums should have come in there, really.
Yeah.
And we did try some stuff with Phil, but it didn't work. So it ended up, because it was going from just no real drums, kind of like Shout before the drums come in there.
It just
lent itself to a moment.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, the moment was just too big. You know, it was demanded. It demanded too much.
Poor orchestra.
Poor bloke. What's he supposed to do?
That is so funny. Yeah. I mean, it's great. Some of it is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Some of the most beautiful recording Tears have done, like the first half, you know.
Yeah.
Just incredible.
Yeah.
Brilliant and the thing. Vocals and stuff, but it's so comedy. If I was Alan Partridge, that's the bit I'd mind to.
that's the Alan Partridge moment now.
Oh my God. Catch my face.
More on McCartney.
I'll tell you a funny story about Chris, if you want. This is brilliant. You'll love this, Dave. Maybe you remember it. So Chris and Ross worked on Flowers in the Dirt, a couple of tracks, right? At the end of the sessions, McCartney's manager said to them, Paul wants to give you a gift as a, you know, a thank you and just to sort of what he does, right? So they thought about it and Ross said, you know, a guitar would be great. And I think he ended up with some SG or some, but he gave him a price. It was like £300 or £400. It wasn't huge, but it was a £300 guitar or whatever it was from McCartney, which is pretty good. Chris asks for a sky aerial.
a sky dish
and it was called a squareal back then. It was like so that's what Chris asked for because he needed one on his house.
Jesus.
So I just thought that was the funniest thing.
I did one thing for him, which was a posthumous mix of Linda's track, and I had to auto tune the fuck out of it. And I thought, is he going to know? Will he realise? Is he going to be offended? And it was like, I can't remember the lyrics, but they were pretty bad.
Trite.
Yeah, you're fucking no one, you stupid shit. Was one of the lines.
No way.
Yeah,
are you serious?
It's having to go at critics.
Oh right, okay. You say I'm lazy. Were they happy?
I think so, yeah.
Never heard.
I was mixing at Abbey Road and Jeff Emmerich was wandering around, which is quite weird.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I'd never heard them call again, I suppose.
Yeah.
First, but then, yeah.
Linda was amazing by all accounts.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, no one has a bad word to say about Linda.
No.
So everyone love Linda.
But Heather Mills. Heather Mills. So there's a you know, very interesting Heather Mills and Paul McCartney, I would say. Bit of karma.
So Dave, you're gonna meet Tears of Fears after the gig.
I'm sure, yeah, hopefully. I mean, Roland's doing the tickets, so hopefully he'll do
Tell him to come on the podcast, yeah? I've done everybody else. We've got
all right.
Roland, yeah?
Have you done Kirk?
They won't go near it after this. We're the B team. They won't fucking turn up. And if they do, they'll deny everything we said. They'll think I'm slagging them, but I'm really not.
That's why I believe it is too late for anyone to believe.
Shall we go to track two?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, Ian, just play it. Don't stop it, okay?
Right.
And talk over the song.
Yeah? Okay, so what were
So we play the song and talk over the song as we're listening to it, and then you can point out any specifics, yeah?
Very good.
Guys, tell me when you're ready and we'll
Try not to fuck it up.
That still worked, though, because you talked over the song, so I can still edit it to the song. It's perfect.
Yeah.
Okay.
All good.
Okay, so three, two, one, and...